tell you what is happening in our capital tonight. First, here room at the White House in Washington.
Gage talking from the newsroom of the White House executive offices. I've just come back from the front porch of the White House itself. Been talking to cabinet members and the members of Congress as they came out after this meeting. You know, the cabinet members went in first, the members of Congress next, while the president presented the information which he had assembled, and he outlined the message which he will deliver to Congress tomorrow at 12:30. That is the announcement that Senator Connally, chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, made when he came out. He was the first one. He came out as we crowded about in there on the porch, across the road. The sidewalk in front of the White House had been blocked off, but on the other side, crowds have been standing for an hour. They're down at the munitions building. The streets are blocked off there. The infantrymen are parading with bayonets fixed. And here, the police are keeping the people back. They're interested. They're quiet. They're a very, very solemn crowd. I had the same feeling here about the feeling in the atmosphere. It's really a feeling of relief. It was the same thing that came in Berlin to those nerve-shattered people when war was declared there. When a war of nerves is over, and that's what the Mikado and his ally Hitler have been conducting for the past month, when that is over, the people who are not actually participating in the physical struggle have a certain sense of relief. And that has come out, I think, in some of the things that the men said very informally when they came out of the White House. For instance, there was Senator Austin of Vermont. He said that when he went in. He said, now I guess there'll be a vacation in politics. Eaton of New Jersey said, well, we'll go to war in the constitutional way, and this ought to unite the country, if anything will. And one of them added, I've forgotten which, this ought to start the workshop moving. Of course, we spoke to the other leaders when it was over. Senator McNary, leader on the Republican side, said, the Republicans will go along with what is done. Sam Rayburn, Speaker of the House, was asked, would there be a declaration of war? That is, would there be a demand in the president's message for that? We asked everyone that. Well, Rayburn said, he didn't answer exactly, somewhat evasively, he said, I think there is one thing in which there is complete unity. We asked Joe Martin, the Republican House leader. Well, he said, this is a serious moment. There is no politics here. There will be none. Well, Sal Bloom came out then, chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee in the House, Foreign Affairs Committee, and we crowded him right into his car asking, does this mean there will be a question of whether the president will ask for an actual declaration of war? And all Bloom would say, don't ask me that. Wait until after the president has spoken tomorrow. That's the feeling. It's a feeling of relief. It's a feeling that the country is more nearly united. That's all, and thanks very much.
That was Borkers in Washington. Here in the NBC newsroom, a bulletin we've just received from Singapore, dated Monday. An air raid on Singapore shortly before dawn caused slight damage and a few civilian casualties. Now here is Robert St. John.
Japanese bombing planes roared out of the sunrise over the Pacific early this morning and began without warning war on the United States. Those planes spread death and destruction over the U.S. territory of Hawaii. Japan acted exactly as her Axis partners had acted so many times before. She attacked without a formal declaration of war. She attacked at dawn on Sunday morning. Now, it's almost evening across the Pacific. In the 10 hours since that first bombing, much has happened. During those 10 hours, Japan has formally declared war on both the United States and Great Britain. Canada has declared war on Japan. The Netherlands East Indies have declared war on Japan. This news reached us in a dramatic telephone conversation between the NBC correspondent off there in Batavia and the NBC newsroom. The declaration called upon the people in the Dutch island to wage an all-out war against the entire Japanese empire. About the same time, Costa Rica declared war on Japan. A Japanese fishing boat anchored off that Central American republic was seized. Japanese natives were promptly arrested. And just a few minutes ago, Nicaragua declared war on Japan. And now comes a bulletin from Mexico City. The Mexican Congress will meet in an emergency session tomorrow to consider a declaration of war against Japan. 10 minutes ago, word flashed across the wire that President Roosevelt will address a joint session of Congress at 12:30 p.m. tomorrow, without a doubt, to consider a declaration of war against Japan. The president met for hours late tonight with his cabinet, a secret emergency session. The War Department estimated 104 dead, more than 300 wounded, among the army men alone, on the island of Oahu, one of the Hawaiian group. This does not include any civilian casualties, which may run into hundreds. Early afternoon reports from the White House that the Japanese also bombed the Philippine Islands have not yet been confirmed from Manila itself. Neither is there any confirmation of a British report that Wake Island, owned by the United States, has been occupied by the Japanese. Nor is there any confirmation of a rumor that Japanese troops have landed in Thailand. At the Chinese port of Shanghai, the Japanese Army and Navy just before dawn surrounded the international settlement. Notice was served on the commander of the U.S. gunboat Wake that war was on. About that same time, a British gunboat anchored nearby suddenly blew up. No harm has thus far befallen any of the Americans or British in the international settlement at Shanghai, as far as we know. All of them have been ordered to remain in their homes. From Maine to California, from Iceland to the Philippines, the United States Army and Navy at this moment are on their toes, ready for action. This very instant, U.S. warplanes and warships may actually be in action. The Panama Canal Zone is on a full wartime footing. All Japanese are being arrested. Aircraft patrol the skies. The cabinet is in an emergency session. The whole canal zone is blacked out. The streets dark, deserted. Here in the United States, the entire nation has become suddenly solidified. North, east, south, west, all sections have sprung into action. All military and naval personnel were ordered to the colors. Army, Navy, and Air Base recalled men on weekend leaves. All furloughs were canceled. A steady stream of soldiers and sailors poured through the streets of large cities, heading back for their posts. From Maine to California, armed guards patrolled industrial plants. Details of watchmen were increased. State police and local officers aided in the precautions against sabotage. The chairman of the House Military Committee said it would take only an hour or two tomorrow to approve legislation so the National Guard and draftees in the Army can be used outside the Western Hemisphere. And now, here is John Vandercook with further comments.
The reckless Japanese aerial attack on Hawaii this morning is still, from the tactical point of view, very hard to understand. Obviously, the high-flying Nipponese attack bombers took off from one or more of Japan's several existing great floating anti-aircraft carriers. Therefore, the bombing, though it has been severe, must be strictly limited in its possible immediate scope. That being the case, what in this incredible move have the Japanese attackers then hoped to accomplish? The dispatches tell us that Pearl Harbor, Hickam Airfield, and the city of Honolulu itself, with its 100,000 population, have all today been under scattered bomb attack. That is a great deal of territory. Pearl Harbor is not a place like the Rock of Gibraltar. It is a location, and a darn big one. Originally, Pearl Harbor, before the Navy got to work on it, was a kind of great salt sea marsh, threaded and interlaced by innumerable winding inlets and arms of the sea. The United States, as very few people remember, has had the possession and use of Pearl Harbor and the lands around it for far longer than Hawaii has been an American territory. In that period of almost 50 years, the channels of the big Pearl Harbor salt marsh have everywhere been dredged and deepened. Immense dockyards and repair slips for even the biggest vessels have been installed, not in a solid lump, but literally miles from each other. All the gray-painted paraphernalia of what has been called and is the most powerful maritime fortress in the world is widely scattered. Between the green, twisting shoreline and islands in Pearl Harbor and the network of crisscross water highways. Hawaii's Pearl Harbor is thus a system, a locality. And incidentally, it is a good 12 miles west along the seashore beyond the city of Honolulu. One need have no fear that such a giant establishment as Pearl Harbor could possibly be put out of business swiftly by even the most powerful aerial attack. Hickam Field, which lies between Pearl Harbor and Honolulu, has been another Japanese target. Hickam Field, where the U.S. Army Air Force in Hawaii is based, too, cannot easily be put out of service. It is dead level, and it is huge. I have stood not at one edge of Hickam Airfield, but in the exact center of it. And even in the blinding clarity of the Hawaiian sunlight, I've been unable to see either side of it. Hickam Field is singularly well built. A stone foundation, carefully graded level and topped by ashes, has been surfaced with a solid platform of concrete and asphalt, for not acres, but for square miles. The plane hangars and barracks, fortunately, are not piled all together in one place, but are scattered. There seems to be only one possible interpretation of the fact of the Japanese attack. Perfidious, sublimely confident, yet sublimely afraid Japan has, under Axis guidance, sought to create a terrible distraction, to trip America and Hawaii's defenses in a vast confusion. But Hawaii, for years, since long before the war, has been ready. The major part of the whole United States fleet now floats on what must be mockingly called the Pacific Ocean. For even longer years, And this fact, too, is not generally known here on the mainland. The biggest single concentration of United States regular army troops has been barracked and is trained for action on that same island of Oahu. It is early, but one safe prediction can be risked. In whatever action comes, Hawaii will give a noble accounting of itself. One thing, though, must be stressed and well remembered through all the months to come. Wherever military action may take place, whatever countries may declare or not declare their belligerent intentions on each other, there is today in this world but one war, a single war, with the United States and Britain and their friends on one side, against Japan, Italy, and Germany on the other. Such a war cannot be waged piecemeal, for it is all one piece. Clearly, the Japanese aggression against Hawaii must bear the blessing of Adolf Hitler, for the Axis works together. Hitler apparently has made Tokyo believe that Russia is or will be beaten. That done, the Nazi Germans somehow, someday, must end this world war their way, first invade and take England. That is the great plan. For that battle won, the east flank of the United States will then, the Axis knows, at once be very dangerously bared. In that broad scheme, the Japanese attack on us must apparently therefore be regarded not as a new front, but as an attack on our rear. One of its main purposes undoubtedly is psychological. We have been slow here in becoming fully aware of what, in terms of its effect on us, has been going on in Europe. Hitler, I think one can say positively, hopes that the American people will now forget Europe even more. Nazi U-boats have failed to stop the movement of American war supplies on the Atlantic. So the Axis now hope that Japan's attack on us may have just that effect. Distracted in the Pacific, the Axis war planners dream that we may now focus all our attention there. That stabbed in the back by Tokyo, we may face round completely. With Europe dropped in our minds to second place, the Axis wishes that the American Navy, American transports, and cargo ships, with their war cargoes, may all be drawn into the Pacific. That is the only way in which Hitler can win the Battle of the Atlantic or consolidate his conquest of the continent of Europe. If in crushing Japan, the United States will weaken herself and drain off much of our strength and of our materiel to the West, then Hitler will have won a tremendous trick. Happily, that strategy is an open secret. And now, here is Robert St. John again with a short bulletin, which he has just brought in.
Here's a bulletin from Singapore. It's been officially announced that the Japanese landed in North Malaya. The invaders are being engaged. There are also reports that a Japanese aircraft carrier has been sunk. But these are roundabout, unconfirmed reports that come to us from London and Panama. Now, about that Singapore bombing, it's reported now that only two bombs fell in the center of the city, although others were heard to explode elsewhere in the island. Now back to John Vandercook.
One point occurs to me, Mr. St. John. Japan now is at war, technically, with more than one-half the total population of this globe. Against 450 million inhabitants of China, against 500 million inhabitants of the British Empire, against 137 million inhabitants of the United States of America, against 60 million people in the Dutch East Indies. Now, those are impressive figures for a nation of 70 million islanders in the North West Pacific Ocean.
Thank you, gentlemen. You've heard a summary of today's events and comments on the future from John W. Vandercook, Robert St. John, and NBC's observer in the nation's capital, Borkus. This is the National Broadcasting Company.